Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2024 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In this podcast series, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2023, both adult and CYA categories, and other authors of historical fiction. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest literary award in Australasia, a heart-stopping $150,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. My bottomless cup of peppermint tea is charged. Let's imagine the past.
Gail Jones is the author of 10 novels, 2 short story collections, and 2 critical works. Her novel, Our Shadows, was shortlisted for the 2021 ARA Historical Novel Prize. In 2023, the piquant and complex Salonika Burney was shortlisted for the Victorian Premier's Literary Award for Fiction and the Voss Literary Prize, but it won the ARA Historical Novel Prize. Gail's work has been translated into several languages. It's an immense pleasure to welcome her to Imagining the Past.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I must say, just so we can add a note of envy to our podcast today, that Gail is actually in Venice, which makes Imagining the Past truly international, I think.
It does. And one of the reasons I travel is to learn. And there's so much, I mean, the historical variousness and complication of Venice is astounding. And I've been reading ever since I arrived. I hadn't come here intending to write anything about Venice, but it's irresistible, the historical, to be in such a historically dense city.
It's such a layered city. Every time I've been there, there's always been a discovery, really.
Indeed.
I always like to start by asking, when did you become interested in writing fiction?
So not until quite late. My background is country Australia and working class. I had no sense of vocation as a writer. In my late 30s, I tried some short stories and then I was hooked. But, you know, that's in today's terms, late 30s is very late. The writers are publishing memoirs at the age of 20. And I feel a little embarrassed, but I didn't have any sense that I could write or would be a writer.
Right, and what kind of inspired you to start with the short stories?
There was a manuscript prize with Fremantle Arts Centre Press, as it was then called. I had planned a journey to Russia, to Siberia, and was about to take out a bank loan to travel to Siberia when I heard about this award and thought, well, I'll just have a go at writing, and I won the prize. I used the money to go to Siberia. So it sounds, again, a little bit pragmatic, even mercenary. But what provoked me was, I mean, bizarrely or perhaps paradoxically, was the wish to travel and to have a bigger life and to see new things, to get lost, to be... to have a more complicated idea of my own place. So, yes, so it's a slightly embarrassing story for me because it doesn't come from an urge to write. Although once I began, I could not stop. There's such pleasure for me in writing.
Well, I think that's an interesting story. I think every writer I interview, I think they've all got different stories of how they arrived at it. Most people say, you know, I wasn't writing in the crib kind of thing. So
Although I keep hearing about it at writers' festivals, other writers saying, you know, they knew from the age of six that they would be a writer and they were surrounded by books, and that just was not my experience. I envy that degree of self-assurance and vocational confidence, but it's not something I ever had.
Were the first ideas you had around Salonika burning, and perhaps you know, what caused you to start developing those ideas?
Salonika Burning is a novel with many beginnings. In the first place, I was following the historical story of a Sydney woman called Olive King, who was a volunteer ambulance driver in World War I. She worked with something called the Scottish Women's Hospital, which was a group of field hospitals, mostly tent hospitals, set up by the Scottish suffragettes in World War I and staffed entirely by women. Many of them volunteers, enlisted from all over the Commonwealth. And Olive had served in France and then found herself in the Scottish Women's Hospital, a tent city near Thessaloniki in Macedonia. So there was that. There was this particular interest in one woman. There was the fact that Salonika is such a fascinating city. I don't know if you want me to talk about this yet. But essentially, I guess it began with this one woman. When I discovered that she was in what was then called Salonika in 1917, I thought it would be interesting to see who else was in the area around about that time. I discovered that the Australian writer Miles Franklin, a British surgeon, Grace Palethorpe, who later became a surrealist painter, and another painter, Stanley Spencer, also British, who became a very famous artist after the war, were also in this particular space at this particular time. And so I thought that I would write about the Great War and the Great Fire, because the city burnt down in 1917, but not from the inside. I don't have that experience. But the idea of foreign witnesses of a local tragedy. So I didn't want to write a novel about the spectacle of the Great Fire or the spectacle of the war. I wanted to write about ideas of witness. Excuse me.
Yeah, I mean, the novel really isn't about Salonika burning, is it? It's the catalyst, maybe, but it's not really the major incidents of the novel.
Well, I do think that there are sort of two contexts. I mean, the first is that the fact that this ancient city was engulfed by fire in 1917, and that Salonika was the port city for the Eastern Front in the First World War. So there are two catastrophes in one place. The etymology of the Greek term, you know, catastrophe, is the idea of a turning point in people's lives. So this is a novel that uses that context, as it were, to pay honour to the tradition, the kind of tragic tradition of the link between ordinary people and huge events. It doesn't... That kind of idea that there is an epic scale to all our ordinary human struggles for meaning. I'm not sure if that makes sense, Greg, but but I see it as an anti-war novel, which honours the humble work of medical staff in the context of large-scale suffering. But it is contextualised by these enormous events, this coincidence of two catastrophes at one moment.
Initially, when I started reading it, it really reminded me of The Unbearable Lightness of Being, in that you weren't so concerned with plot. Like, my memory of The Unbearable Lightness of Being was that the plot's pretty much dismissed in the first kind of few pages, and then it's retold and retold through these different voices. Your novel has a very complex structure, and the puzzle-like aspect of the novel was intriguing. Perhaps you could describe and talk about how you arrived at that structure.
I'm glad you like the form, because I'm also fascinated by narrative form. I plot is less interesting to me than the unfolding of an experience. And I should stress this is a work of fiction, not of history. That might be a place to begin. I've tried to stay true to known historical conditions. So, for example, this is a novel that represents endemic malaria, which killed many locals and many soldiers in Salonika. Salonika was, as I said, the port city for the Allied forces of the Eastern Front. And the historical figure, Olive, was stationed at the city in 1917 and witnessed the destruction of the city. So the form, what I wanted was a form that gave points of view from four characters. In other words, it dispersed vision. I didn't want an omniscient vision of the war that made it all intelligible. I wanted there to be human bafflement, human complication and suffering. I wanted there to be a sort of modernist interest in the inner lives of characters. So, of course, there are huge events happening historically and in the background to my narrative. And there is a plot. There's something happens at the end, and I hope there won't be a spoiler in our talk.
No, I didn't. I didn't mean to suggest there's no plot. No. It's more about your emphasis of things.
Yes, yeah. Thank you. Yes. No, I mean, that's my sense of it too, Greg, that the emphasis is on that aspect of life that's not often represented in war narratives, which is memory, desire, fear, ordinary things happening like getting an anti-malarial injection, struggling to find food, being puzzled and distressed, the element of distress of witnessing so many mutilated bodies and so much suffering. So war narratives tend to be omniscient. They tend to, especially war histories, of course, they try to give a logic to events. They look at mass movements of people. They look at history as a coherent narrative. I wanted to make it fractured and incoherent in as much as it moves again and again between different points of view. So there's a field of witness, as it were, and the mystery of what I think of as the mystery of adjacency, how different, how people standing together might witness things differently, how some characters notice one thing and some another. Technically, the issue of point of view was very important to me.
And that's one thing I wanted to discuss with you, is that all of the four narrators are all in third-person point of view, which I thought gave a lovely kind of homogeneousness to the novel. I think other authors would have felt the need to delineate their characters with having different points of view or tenses. Did you consider doing that, or did you always conceive of it that there would be this kind of overarching, kind of almost like a pall over the novel?
That's a very interesting question. I am interested in point of view, and my point of view, and I mean, I teach literature, or have for a long time, so I'm aware of the technical aspects of the novel. In the idea of point of view, there exists a notion of what is sometimes called focalization. So who tells the narrative and who sees the action is not always the same point of view. So there is third person, but each section of the novel is focalized through one figure. And sometimes that focalization moves to what is called free indirect discourse, which is what Flaubert used, when you actually feel you're entering the thoughts of a character. So although I'm not sure I'd agree that they're homogeneous, I think they're very formally, there's a kind of formal stringency to the text, but I think the characters are very easily distinguished because this is a novel that's interested in subjectivity, memory, desire, fear. Because it's a novel from the inside, And one of my models here is Virginia Woolf, perhaps rather obviously. I had taught her 1922 novel called Mrs. Dalloway, which tracks one woman moving around London on one day, gathering things for a dinner party. But her story is intercepted by that of a shell-shocked soldier who has returned from the First World War and who is suffering terrible anguish and recurrent hallucinations as he moves around London at the same time. At the end of her novel, and people say nothing happens in this novel, at the end of her novel she has her dinner party, but at the same time the soldier suicides. And so it was that idea that beneath the sort of conventions of an everyday narrative, there is a suffering narrative that also deserves to be told. And I had in mind, I suppose, this other character who called Septimus Smith in Mrs. Dalloway, whose story is not noticed by a certain strata of society for whom things are much more complacent, safer, much more devoted to individual pleasure. Perhaps I'm getting off the track a bit here, but this is partly about why I wanted to emphasize subjectivity and memory rather than some objective idea of what was happening. I think that was a rather laboured and long-winded way of talking about my sense of, I guess, the politics of the novel, that it's looking at the unregarded in the historical narrative.
Yeah, I think you've kind of got on to my next question, which was about how to differentiate the characters, which, you know, clearly you have done through focalization. So did you, how much did you experiment with that to arrive at the form that you ended up using?
I didn't experiment at all. I decided from the beginning that I didn't want a master narrative or a confident omniscience. What I wanted was something that worked in a sort of spiral, actually. There's a very strict order to these. So this is not a book, as you are aware, it's not a book with chapters, it's a book with small narrative sequences. They always unfold in exactly the same order. It's a very strict order and it doesn't break. So there's a sense of moving between each, I think, in a kind of spiral towards some event. There's, I hope, a building up of tension towards the ending, and also the sense almost of claustrophobia, that living in a tent city with other people, sleeping in the same quarters, having little privacy, having no emotional space to feel what one needs to feel in situations of calamity or catastrophe. I hope that that's there also in the form, oddly, if that makes sense.
No, I think it's really very obvious. I really enjoyed the rigidness of the structure because it brought a sense of relaxing, to be honest, in a way.
Interesting.
It allowed an element to be fixed, I would say.
No, that does interest me a lot because I did want to make the structure expressive. I wanted there to be some sense that some scenes do interpenetrate, some are multiply witnessed, some are extremely private. So when a character reads a letter or has a memory, obviously these are enclosed in another narrative ontology, as it were. And my technical complexity is part of a wish to express these kinds of paradoxes that I've been describing, of being both together and apart at a time of catastrophe, so that in every historical catastrophe, it's so important to remember that these are individuals as irreducibly complex as we are, as, with their own life worlds of memory, emotion, ambition, all of the things that make us think of individuals rather than masses. And one of the, I think, tragedies of war and tragedies of the epic scale is that it loses the idea of the individual tragedy. So that being together and being apart is an axis, if you like. I hope for the reader a kind of affective axis of the experience of this unfolding novel.
I thought when you did start to tell events from different points of view, but from different characters again, it added another level of kind of tension into it, which I thought was one of the elements that actually kept driving the novel forward.
I think this is a propulsive novel in the sense that there is the fire, but the outcome of the fire graphically described. So this novel opens with a view from the distance, soldiers standing on a hill looking at the fire of Salonika and finding it beautiful. And then a little, I guess, as kind of symbolic allegory of a painter of that time, a painter who describes, who was a floral painter, a painter of flowers, very, very rich, successful painter, embedded with the Salonika forces, who went up in a hot air balloon the day after the fire began. The city burnt for 3 days, and painted these very beautiful, wafty pink and mauve and lemon yellow clouds above the city. So I wanted there to be constantly a sense of distances opening and closing, the distances of vision, what it means to aestheticize, the immorality of aestheticizing human tragedy in that context, and then to plunge from there right into the lives of people on the ground. And the only witness, and Olive King was the only one of those four to actually witness the fire of Salonika. She wrote letters to her father, which I read, and which helped me think about what she saw. But that idea of scales of witness, scales of aestheticization, scales of distance and intimacy, was very much what I was preoccupied with in attempting this novel. And my other constraint, so I had this vast ambition, but I had the constraint of a very condensed, poetic, short novel. And that was partly the circumstances of its creation, but I didn't have the time or space to write an expansive novel, so kept wanting to force a sort of emotional pressure on my characters and to concentrate both the action and the experiential field of what was going on.
Whilst the structure is incredibly rigid, the way you rotate or spiral, as you've said, through the four characters, we do go back to Olive as the last small narration. I just kind of felt that really stood out, and I'm just wondering what that was kind of telling us, that we'd return to Olive.
Well, that's true. The novel begins with Olive and ends with Olive.
Mm.
And that seemed to me important. She's the non-artist figure, as it were. The other three all became famous, very famous, in Stanley Spencer's case. He was offered a knighthood. He became very wealthy, very unusual, important British painter. Grace had a fascinating career, becoming, after the war, a Freudian psychoanalyst, and then a very successful surrealist painter. She was the only English woman included in Dalí's surrealist exhibition in 1938, I think it was. She went to New York and was a painter there. She also did art therapy, invented the idea of art therapy, which she practiced in prisons. So, and of course, we all know about Stella Miles Franklin, who is a very important Australian writer. It was a piece of good luck for me that her what she wrote about Macedonia was published in the year I was writing the book in a fairly obscure Macedonian journal. The whole of her report was published. So I was able to get hold of that online and see what she wrote. And Miles Franklin was very much a woman of her time. She had the prejudices and the racism of her own time deeply internalized, and it was quite shocking to read her ignorance, her narcissism, and her self-congratulatory tone. So I had a sense, I suppose, of not wanting to give the last word to the famous figures, but to this woman who returned to Sydney after the war and basically did social work. She was also a remarkable woman, but she didn't have that. She didn't have a career representing her own experience as the other three did.
Right. That's a lovely turn for the end of it, isn't it? That you've ended with, you know, the common person rather than the famous or the successful.
I'm delighted you noticed it, Greg. You're the first person to comment on this. And for me, it was really quite important, since the novel opened with an allegory about perspective and how art benefits, in a sense, from inducing a removed perspective and seeing things formally as... Well, the fire was described as sublime. I mean, fires are often very beautiful.
Well, fires are cleansing as well. They're not just destructive.
And in the Greek tradition, they're also sacralized. So there are all sorts of things going on there in the opening that I wanted to critique through the everyday, through the modernist preoccupation with the centrality of every human experience, every individual and private experience having its own, or mattering, having its own claim on meaning, that not all meanings are public or arty. You know, some are internal and unspoken.
I'd like to just talk about your research a little bit more. I think just from the conversation today, you spoke how Olive was the first character you kind of started researching. If she was the first character that you started researching, did that kind of end up having some momentum for you with that character as well?
And perhaps, I mean, the attachment was in part, my mother was very interested in family history. And it occurred to me that given Olive's background, she may well be one of our relatives. So I had looked up Olive years ago when I first heard about her, and I had read her the collection of her letters to her father, which were published by her niece. I'd read them in Canberra not that long ago, about 3 years ago. However, I was a carer in a small country town in WA when I wrote this book. So the research, and it was written during the COVID period, so the research was almost entirely online. I was not in a position to visit libraries, which were shut for COVID, although I did order one or two books online. The first thing to say is that the Imperial War Museum in London has a huge online archive. So the Scottish Women's Hospital, for example, is very well documented. The second thing I should mention is that there was a particular book, Mark Mazzara's book called City of Ghosts, which is a history of Salonika, which did come through the system to a tiny West Australian country town, which I read, although it only has two pages on the Great Fire of Salonika. I understood, I think, why I was attracted to this place and the idea of this place. I'm very attracted to port cities, cities that are at the crossroads of many cultures and nations and have the contradictions of empire written within them as well. And what Mark Mazzara's book revealed to me was that this was a remarkable place for five centuries under the rule of the Ottoman Turks. So it was once Byzantine, then taken over in 1430 by the Ottoman Turks, and became an Islamic outpost on the edge of Europe, vastly enriched culturally by the Jews who were expelled from Spain in 1492 under the famous Umbra Decree. So it was an unusual city in that it had a very large Jewish population, the largest in Europe, a Greek Orthodox Christian population, and a Muslim population who more or less lived in peace for five centuries. In 1912, the Greeks expelled the Muslims and knocked down all of the minarets and changed the city and Hellenized the city. In 1944, the Germans deported 50,000 Jews from Salonika to Auschwitz. So I had this odd coalition. I'm very interested in history, and I had this odd coalition of these individual stories. And I knew about Grace Palethorpe and Stanley Spencer already. I knew, of course, about Miles Franklin. I had these very individual stories alongside this setting, as it were, of an astonishingly interesting city that had been at once the hope of a sort of model of world peace. And then, that's putting it way too grandiosely. But just a city that had its own layers, and that in 1917 was burnt down just as it was the Eastern Front, the port city for the Eastern Front. So there was a collection of soldiers almost entirely from the British Commonwealth or from the colonies. So soldiers from the French colonies, places like Vietnam, soldiers from New Zealand, Australia, Canada. So that combination of a setting that I loved reading about, these individual narratives and their preoccupation with art and representation, and then the idea that this woman from Sydney had turned up there in the midst of it, where she was the daughter of a wealthy widower who could afford to buy her own ambulance. So she was in her own way exceptional and unusual and very brave, I think. I was very struck by Olive King's guts and bravery. Yeah,
it's incredibly courageous of like all four, really.
Well, I think the one who wasn't, and I hesitate saying this, was Miles Franklin. But I think... She was there looking for a good story. She also wanted the bigger life, but she suffered because all of those four historical figures were sent back to England because of malaria. They all had terrible malaria when they were there. Miles lasted, I think, less than 6 months, and was not really a researcher or not very historically aware. She was a feminist. She was a feisty and fascinating thinker. But there's something in her self-aggrandizing, heroizing of her own life that I think the others didn't share. And so reading her account actually made me much less interested in giving her any kind of starring role, as it were.
You just spoke about this a little bit with the novel was written during COVID, and sounds like a bit of your research was done. We all know that was an incredibly inhibiting kind of time. So what effect do you think that had on the writing and on the research? Was it, do you feel like it did hinder you or did it stimulate you?
My situation was that I was caring for my mother. So I spent a year in a small country town caring for my mother. So for me, it was a very personally difficult time. I didn't expect to write anything. And when I made a choice, I was talking to my mother about this woman, Alice King. And she, my mother became interested in the story, and so I started writing something for her, to put it simply. And so I didn't think of it as, I don't at all think of it as a COVID novel, although of course there is a, there is pestilence in my book. There are people suffering mass deaths, and indeed there are nurses in masks, and the idea of the mask is an important one in this book. So it was very emotionally overdetermined, I think is the word.
Maybe we could just talk a little about some of your craft. So what is your writing process? Do you plan a first draft fairly detailedly, or do you just start writing and let it unfold?
No planning, none whatsoever. So that's not a boast. It's that I'm incapable of planning, I think, and it's not just not the way that I work. I start with something that seems to me symbolically or affectively charged. So in this case, it was the idea of soldiers standing at a distance, looking at a city burning and finding it beautiful. And for me, thinking through the ethical challenge of that alongside what I knew of four people who were there, who were on the ground, who were dealing daily with the bodies of mutilated soldiers, who, especially Grace, who was really an extraordinary woman, I think, a surgeon. There weren't very many surgeons, women surgeons in those days. And she was there, had been working for the Scottish Women's Hospital for quite a while. So these are probably four people suffering war trauma. So I start with an image or a moment. All of my novels have begun in this way. And I just let the novel unfold. I've never planned a novel. For me, the pleasure of writing is the pleasure of plunging into the darkness. It's the pleasure of actually seeing where a certain kind of poetic logic, rather than a syllogistic logic, will take me. I had read about Salonika, but I've never been to Salonika. This is the only time I've written a novel about a place that I haven't visited, because it was impossible to visit. It was impossible to leave Australia. And I felt a lot of hesitation and caution, sort of ethical caution about that. So I knew I couldn't have anything from a Macedonian point of view, and I knew that I was relying on second-hand material in terms of what the place looked like and so on. But I wanted a poetic logic to the book, and my books do tend to have, as it were, streamers of imagery. They do have to seem to have tropes, repetitions, images around which a great deal clusters in terms of how I want a reader to encounter that image. So I rely on that, and I just cross my fingers and hope it will unfold. And then so much of writing is intuitive. I have come across authors who tell me they plan their novels. I've come across an author who plans her novels according to algorithms, and she showed me the algorithm of one of her novels. And I think, where is the pleasure there? It's like colouring in and staying behind the lines. I like the idea of being surprised by one's own thinking and writing and leaving that possibility open.
Yeah, I think I've always tried a mix of the two. I kind of feel like I have to have some idea of where I'm heading, but I leave that organic as well. So the novel can surprise. Because it does, as you've said, you know, those things that just come out of left field are the really other things that are just so enjoyable. And particularly when something just marries up with something that's 200 pages before and it just comes out of the blue and marries up perfectly, there's not a better feeling, I don't think. Do you enjoy editing, though?
Yes, I do enjoy editing. I mostly edit as I go. I don't go through lots of drafts. So I have a great trust in form, and I suppose some of that comes not from being a teacher of literature, and I don't teach creative writing, I teach literature. But from reading, from knowing what it is possible to do in a novel, and when younger writers ask for advice, and I know it sounds corny and it sounds like a truism, but I say, read as widely as you can. Notice what moves and excites you. Notice what bores you. You know, that's not for you. That will not be your mode. That will not help your process. But I do read a lot, and I have read a lot, and I think that my sense of the ways it is possible for a novel to open out has definitely been enhanced by my dedication to reading.
Yeah, I think the subconscious, those rhythms that happen in a well-written novel, you become attuned to those subconsciously almost. So when you're writing, kind of know where certain things have to happen and where certain rhythms have to be placed, I think. And that's, to me, is subconscious.
I agree. A lot of that happens with a different kind of attunement, if that's the word. So one becomes attuned to points of intensity and points of quiet. And there's a sense that we know from our own lives of how things as simple as a conversation might work, that there are points where you have to go quiet or retract or withdraw and not say too much.
I think that's a lovely image for it as well, of just basic conversation, because when we're conversing, we're telling stories.
Indeed, yes, that's right. And also, I mean, speaking of something like war, I mean, I'm from a generation where, you know, I saw my grandfather return from war. No, I didn't see him return from war, but I'm aware that that many, many men return from something like war and cannot speak. They cannot or will not put words to their experience. And there's an honour to that, as well as an honour to representation. And keeping that in mind, that there are some things that are ineluctable, that are necessarily kept private, or that are too traumatic to bear the additional weight of expression or words, keeping that dynamic in play seems to me very important dealing with this kind of experience. My own father was a very quiet man, but his inner life was no less intense than mine. So, you know, words are not everything, and there's a necessary humility in writing, I think, in being reminded of that.
I'm always interested in how much one project pollinates the next or other projects. Do your projects cross-pollinate? Like, how much does Salonika Burning owe to Our Shadows, and indeed your newer novel, One Another, to Salonika Burning?
They do cross-pollinate. I rather like the bee metaphor. I was a beekeeper for a while, but alas, I'm allergic to bee stings, so I had to give it up. They cross-pollinate because it's the governing consciousness, I guess, of the writer is the constant in all of the works. So there are emotional configurations, tropes, linguistic preoccupations, stylistic tics that recur. And I've had critics point this out to me, writing on my work or studying my work. I've discovered that I'm obsessed with sky and with weather, to the point of idiocy, perhaps. And I'm not going to relinquish that. I like looking at the sky, and I like thinking about the weather. And so these will figure in each text that I write, and often they will figure in a symbolic way. They will be configured. They will be constellated as something that matters to me, not just as setting. I really hate that word, setting. But as part of the emotional resonance of being alive that one attends to, as we were talking about before this talk began, attends to what the world is like out there outside our windows. And that's a beautiful thing, and it will inevitably recur in all my books. So yes, the projects cross-pollinate. There are certain, I suppose, in the broadest sense of the term, political preoccupations I have about how to esteem people who are silent or traumatized or have experienced the hurt of history. And there's an abiding interest in the aesthetic, in what does an image mean? What can a film do that words can't? What can words do that films can't? You know, what is the status of those images that penetrate us, that live with us, that we carry maybe throughout our entire lives, that perhaps we've carried since we were 8 years old? You know, that idea of the self through time is a very important theme for me, and I'm sure it's in all of my books.
You've mentioned earlier on that Salonika burning is fiction. I'm just wondering, what do you think historical fiction can achieve?
A very good historical fiction. So I'm thinking of the work, say, of Hilary Mantel, has a duty to internalize the research, to research with integrity and care, and then to make it the invisible texture of the work. And her work, for example, relies on very dense historical knowledge, small details like clothes and food, and very strict codes of plausibility. So this is traditional historical fiction worthy of respect because it attempts to honour what I call the historical imaginary, that the wish to understand in a kind of imaginative excursion the humanity of earlier figures in history. And this might be our grandparents or our great-grandparents. So, and as I said, to grant them respect, to see people in history as irreducibly complex as we are now. So every generation thinks of itself as at the front of history. That's how we think of ourselves now. We are at the front of history, and history is sort of streaming behind us. But I do think that what we have to remember is that it was the same for our great-grandparents. They also thought they were at the beginning of history. Sorry, the front of history. They didn't know what future would unfold. We don't know what will unfold in the future. And there's something very interesting going on there about time and how we imagine time, how we give it its fullness, its plenitude, imaginatively and respectfully. I mean, that's a very, sorry, Baroque answer to your question. But in my novel, Salonika Burning is about imagining witness. So I read a lot of history almost entirely online, I have to say, looked at a lot of photographs, but I wanted a history from the inside. And I didn't move beyond 1917. I didn't say, and here's what happened to Grace Palethorpe after she, you know, I didn't want there to be a future. I wanted it to be within that moment and sequestered in the bubble of that moment of not knowing what will happen, not knowing if you will die tomorrow of malaria. And certainly, having dissed Miles Franklin, I think she was afraid for her life. I think she suffered terribly in Macedonia and was full of fear that she didn't know that she would survive malaria. She was the one who got it very bad when she was there. And that changes a person, that we know the future, they do not.
That's a very interesting point, isn't it? When you as a modern reader come to a novel and you know the future. Yeah.
Yes, I think that's a really fascinating intellectual or theoretical question that I'd like to spend more time on. I suppose also there are lots of aesthetic, there are lots of examples of writers being worried about issues of scale. So one of my references for this book was W.H. Auden's Musée des Beaux-Arts, written in 1938. And it's a poem written about a painting, Bruegel the Elder, I think, not the younger, Bruegel's painting of Icarus falling out of the sky. It's a painting from the 1560s. And it begins, about suffering they were never wrong, the old masters, how well they understood its human position, how it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully down a street. And I love the rhythms of that. Oh. And he goes on to, he's a Greek mythic figure falling from the sky in a blaze of glory. And the horse of the plowman, a horse is scratching its bum against a tree. And people are continuing their ordinary lives. And that idea that there are atrocities going on in the world and we are continuing our ordinary lives, how does that challenge us to think differently? What does that mean for us? I love that poem. I mean, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but it's about this issue of distance and intimacy and the fact that we live in a world where things that are terrible, that are atrocious, are also happening as we are opening the window. That's quite a challenge to think about.
Gordon did that a lot, though, the way
he did, yes.
The extraordinary with the most ordinary kind of situations and words.
That's right. He's not so popular now, but I still really like Auden. His one of the poems I consulted when I was writing this novel is his poem about the death of Freud, which is also kind of astonishing. It's got some astonishing lines in it.
What are you working on now? I know we've mentioned you have a new novel out, One Another, and are you working on something else as well now?
So the next novel is done. It will come out next year, which is a bit too early for the publishers. They don't like bringing out novels too close together. It's a kind of literary crime novel set in Sydney and Broken Hill, and it's in the present, so it's not a historical text. And I have a larger project that links Japan and Spain, for which I've done a lot of travel but had no writing time. So that one is in Kuwait. Who knows? I'm not sure what will come after that.
Well, you're like the Lithgow Flash. You're very quick.
Lithgow Flash, I'll remember that. okay. I'm taking that as a compliment, not as an indication of how facile.
No. It was only a compliment.
Thank you.
Just to finish up today, you won the 2023 ARA Historical Novel Prize. I'm just wondering what you think the role of these prizes are and what did winning that mean to you?
It meant a great deal because it's enabled me to have proper writing time. I've left my university job and I'm writing full-time. It's the first time in my life I've been able to be a full-time writer. I don't think that it's easy to feel cynical about the prize culture, but I think that every writer who is awarded a prize is immensely grateful. It just makes things a bit easier. I've been a part-time academic for a long time, but never a full-time writer, and this is a great gift for which I'm very grateful to Ara.
Well, thank you very much for your time today. As I said at the beginning of our interview, I'm green with envy that you're in Venice and I'm in Sydney. But I've really enjoyed our chat today.
Likewise, and thank you for your brilliant questions. I feel I have a very clever reader and I never underestimate my readers. They're always telling me things I didn't notice or pointing out facts I didn't know. So thank you.
Well, thank you for your time. Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2024 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find interviews with many illuminary. Subscribe to the podcast series wherever you listen to be notified when new episodes drop. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's happening in historical fiction. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.